Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
This is a special edition of On the Wing podcast. As the wildfires in Texas and Oklahoma move closer to containment, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever want to extend our sincerest condolences to all those affected by these catastrophic wildfires. Our thoughts are with the residents of both states, especially those families who have lost loved ones and those folks who have lost livelihoods during these wildfires. As is human nature, people also are wondering about the impact these wildfires have had on wildlife, particularly bobwhite quail. And we've received a number of questions via our social media channels to that point. On today's episode, I'm pleased to be joined by three wildlife biologists from the Southern Great Plains who can help answer those questions. They'll also point us towards some ways to fight fire with fire as a means of mitigating similar wildfire catastrophes down the road. And in the interest of full transparency, I had a podcast recorded about this very issue, prescribed fire for wildlife and to mitigate wildfires, recorded, ready to drop this week, but it was recorded before any of the events in Texas and Oklahoma happened, and it felt a bit tone deaf to release that without addressing current events in Texas and Oklahoma. So we're inserting this particular episode in front of an episode you'll learn about a brand new book called Ignition in just a couple of weeks. So in light of the current events in Texas and Oklahoma, I'm pleased to be joined by those three biologists I mentioned. Tell Judkins, the upland game biologist for Oklahoma's Department of Wildlife Conservation. John McLaughlin, the upland game bird program leader at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And Thomas Yonke, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's state coordinator for the state of Texas. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. Talk about what's gone on the last few weeks in Texas and Oklahoma. We'll start with Tell, the first Tell I've ever met.
Good deal.
Tell, I'll ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners, kind of where you're from, what you do for a living, what you do for the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. First, thanks for having me on. I greatly appreciate it. I've listened to numerous episodes of On the Wing, so I'm glad to be on it finally. I've been with ODWC for about 10 years. I've been in this role for about 5 years. Prior to that, I was actually a game warden. Don't hold that against me. So I've tried to try this whole new, more relaxed look. I like it. But born and bred in Oklahoma, originally from a little town called Marlow, grew up in Rush Springs. So if you've ever heard of those, you know your Oklahoma towns. Otherwise, it's just south of Oklahoma City. But yeah, thanks for having me on.
A game warden before, I got checked, I think 6 times this hunting season. Is there, as you think back to your game warden days, I'll clarify, I never got a ticket. I was never doing anything wrong.
That's how the story always goes. Yeah. I wasn't doing anything wrong.
Just checked. But, do you remember like going around the corner and checking the same person over and over and over one hunting season?
A lot of times, especially, and it wasn't necessarily upland hunters. Where I was a warden at in central Oklahoma, there wasn't a lot of upland hunting. But you know, you get into the a role where you're checking the same fishermen almost every day, or you're checking the same duck hunters every day. It definitely gets where you're starting to see the same faces over and over again. Probably means you were in a good hunting spot if you're getting checked that many times.
Honestly, it happened in multiple states. Rooster Road Trip this year, we got checked back-to-back states in Iowa and Nebraska. I got checked in the Minnesota pheasant opener. I get checked in the Wisconsin Grouse. I don't know. I never was doing anything wrong, but I look, I guess I look questionable.
Sometimes if there's no luck, it's bad luck, right?
Yeah. Well, they're always super friendly, especially once I got everything I needed, you know, or checked out that I had everything I needed. But
that's good.
John McLaughlin, were you ever a game warden before you were a wildlife biologist with Texas?
Definitely not. No, I never had any desire to go into a hunter's camp and start asking questions. So, I keep to myself for the most part, but, no, Bob, really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And, I would just, echo your comments before. You know, our hearts go out to the people of the panhandle of Texas over in Oklahoma. You know, this region is, they're not, no stranger to some of these larger wildfire catastrophes. They've been hit with a couple of big tornadoes, you know, Perryton and Matador in the last couple of years. So this region has really been through it. So our hearts go out to them, and it's great to see all the mustering of effort and resources and all the people that have been coming together to really help those people out because they need it and they're a great community. So, just echo those comments. But, yeah, thanks for having me here today. I do serve as the Upland Game Bird Program Leader for Texas Parks and Wildlife. Primarily responsible for our quail species, pheasant, and then our grouse. So we do have lesser prairie chicken in the state. And then I do officially cover a little tropical bird in the south of Texas called the chachalaca, which you can hunt. You can get down there and do it. But we don't do much for those birds. They're mostly south of the border. But been with the department for 7 years. Know Tell and Thomas, you know, very well. We all work together on a lot of different initiatives, whether that be outreach and education to the regulatory habitat management side of things. And as Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, you know, fantastic partner for us down in Texas, growing at an unbelievable pace. And so we really appreciate them being here and appreciate the opportunity to participate in the podcast today.
Yeah, well, thank you for making time. I trolled you both. Our troll is probably the wrong word, creeped on both of your LinkedIn pages. And I saw a Minnesota connection for you, John. You were a biologist with the DNR for like 6-8 months?
Yeah, that's funny you found that. Yeah, no, it's, early in the career, you're sort of, bouncing around, just trying to find different opportunities that come up. And so, yeah, I was born and raised in New England, and I got the go west, young man, as our emergency alarms go off here. But I got the go west, young man. I spent a lot of years out west, and then I took a job doing some sharp-tailed grouse there in central Minnesota, just around Aitken area. And so I had a chance to get destroyed by mosquitoes and about everything that could make me sneeze on the planet. So, but no, I spent a little time there before I came to grad school. But I will say the folks up there were incredible, and they were the first ones that took me out ice fishing, and we did a lot of great things up there. I think I have this one memory of kind of going out, wanting to walk across a lake, and I'm sort of, walking 10 feet out, putting my feet on it, sort of stomping at it, like, is this safe? Can I go out with my dog? And I think a Ford 3/4 ton, about 100 yards down, just drove right out onto the ice. So I said, probably okay. But no, it's great people up there. Loved that time up there, even though it was short. But a little brief connection to Minnesota.
It's pretty funny the interest in ice fishing from upland biologists or across the southern part of the Michael Hook, who is the upland biologist in South Carolina, is a frequent listener. I do a little radio show in the Twin Cities. Every Saturday morning, hunting, fishing, conservation, and Michael is just fascinated by ice fishing from South Carolina. Listens darn near every week for the ice fishing report in Minnesota. So it's kind of funny to hear that. Ice fishing is a connector that never would have predicted in the upland world.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. I went with a lot of kids who were way better than I was. So it was a humbling experience, but we had a lot of panfish for the winter. So it was fun.
Well, I really appreciate you both making time, rounding out our group today. Thomas Yonke, making his first appearance on the podcast, the state coordinator, the first ever state coordinator we had, for the state of Texas. Thomas, thank you very much for making time.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. And Man, just really appreciate the organization being so cognizant of everything that's happening. There's just been an outpouring of inquiries and emails from all levels, be it the chapter side here in Texas, up to some regional leadership and even national leadership, just trying to figure out, hey, we see what's going on in the news, what's a more in tune pulse, and what can we do? So that's been appreciated. On a much more lighter hearted note, I love the fact that John brought up that he is the quote unquote chachalaca expert. He didn't say that word, but that's what I'm going to put in there. And I'm waiting to hear his imitation of one of those little velociraptor calls one of these days on a podcast.
Not today.
I was thinking the same thing. There will be a special episode of On the Wing devoted exclusively to chachalacas. Did I say that correctly? Chachalacas?
Yeah, you got it.
So we will do that down the road. That's very intriguing for sure.
Sounds like there'll have to be like a bandage sponsorship in there from the stories I've heard of chachalaca.
That would be a whole nother road trip you got down there. You got your that would be an on the border road trip, and then just hunting all your border species, maybe starting in California, working, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and you got to end with chachalaca down at the valley.
How do they taste?
I have no idea.
I couldn't tell you either. Yeah. I suppose they're edible.
I know biologists that pursue them, and I know one of our friends, old Robert Perez, he lights up talking about them, but other than that, I really don't I don't know.
Well, yeah, he's never told a story about eating them. I've heard all of the stories about going after them. I think that's where more of the heartburn comes from. But yeah, I assume they're not too bad at table fare.
Huh? What do they eat?
I don't know.
Gregarious, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Small yeah. children.
yeah. We had some missing reports in the last few weeks, so yeah, we got to get on it.
All right. So, Tawas, we'll circle back. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So been fortunate and blessed to be with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever about 3.5 years now. Prior to my role as state coordinator, I was our prescribed fire coordinator. So I joke with folks and say, you know, I used to get to light fires for a living. Now I get to be a part of meetings and identify and put out the figurative ones. And I don't think it takes much figuring out which one's more enjoyable. But I will say that I was on a fire yesterday. It went smoothly, and we were, and in our backup plan, if that south wind would have been strong enough to tell, we were going to be sending it into your country because we were just south of the Red River.
Right. But yeah. Some of that country could use it for sure.
It all went really well. Had a great support of our team members and landowners, and chalked up some new first-time burners and got some good habitat out of the deal as well. And I think they're projected to potentially get some rain today. So we're pretty tickled about that one.
Good deal. You know, so I want to reiterate as we dive into the kind of the meat of this conversation, reiterate that our thoughts absolutely go out to the people in the communities impacted by these fires. Our role at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever is the wildlife and the wildlife habitat. And that's what I want to focus on for this conversation. And let's start with kind of the current situation as we record this on Thursday, March the 14th, starting with Oklahoma. Are there wildfires still rolling out of uncontained in Oklahoma, Tel?
So I believe there's a couple of smaller scale ones that are still technically not 100% contained. So far in 2024, we've seen about 150,000 acres that have been burned by wildfire. We've probably seen just as many acres that have been burned by prescribed fire, but we'll hold off on talking about those until a little later. Right now, our numbers we're looking at, we've lost about 19 homes across 4 counties. And when we're talking about those devastating effects, the human and livestock and livelihood side is so much more of a devastating impact than what we see with wildlife impacts. Mm-hmm. The plants and animals that are here across the southern plains have evolved with fire. So they're going to be able to make it. They're going to be able to survive these impacts. the human side is definitely the hardest thing to overcome, losing a home, losing a life, losing a livelihood through your livestock. But for the most part, it'll take time, of course, but the wildlife, the plants, the animals, the forbs, the wildflowers, those will all bounce back pretty quickly, especially compared to the human side.
Yeah. And you said 150,000 acres currently impacted by wildfires?
Yes, somewhere between 150,000, 175,000 acres is the current number, depending on what your news source is.
Which is a big number, but then you go to Texas, and it's staggering. What's the current situation in Texas, John?
Yeah, so, fortunately, there's three really big fires that, came out of that. They all started in late February, actually right ahead of Pheasant Fest, up there in South Dakota. And so, we actually left the state as skies were a bit smoked out down here. But, three big fires. We had the Smokehouse Creek fire. So that's the biggest of the three. And that's burned about 1.1 million acres.
Wow.
Yeah, just a huge total. And then we kind of had another fire very close by called the Windy Deuce that burned about 150,000. And then, what fortunately, we call it the Grapevine Creek fire down a little bit farther south. That's at about 35,000 acres. Fortunately, that one we all felt like was going to get out of control. But in terms of containment at this point, last couple of weeks, I think the estimates are roughly 90% contained on all of those, which, 90% is great. We'd love to see them completely extinguished, obviously. Here in West Texas, wind is a part of this country's DNA. There's a reason we've got so much wind energy down here. Love it or hate it, it's here because of that. So, and that was really a leading factor in these fires, dry conditions, and that wind picked up. I mean, they believe it started from a power pole. So, that thing moved pretty quickly. So, this region has just, really been through it. Again, they had about a 900,000 acre fire in a very similar region back in 06, and then another 400,000 in this area back in 17. And just for your listeners, if you can visualize Texas, because I understand not everyone's from Texas, if you think about the state's outline, we have that sort of rectangular boot at the northern end. So that's really the region we are talking about. That's what we refer to as the Panhandle region. And we're talking about the eastern side of that Panhandle. So if you go northeast out of Amarillo, that's when you start getting in the beginning of the fire and it burned right over to the Oklahoma border. So, we feel like we're in a good spot now, but, in this country, you just want it all the way out. The wind's blowing again today. Luckily, we have a cold front moving in tomorrow. It's supposed to drop down to the 50s and get cool. So I think that's going to hopefully help these firefighters and these communities sort of tamp everything out. And then we're still going into the fire season now, but at least, try and handle what we've got on the table right now. So
you mentioned that the suspicion is one of these fires started through a power line. How did that happen?
I'm not aware of all the details, but we have a lot of infrastructure out here for all sorts of reasons, not just for our local communities, but for energy, whatever it may be. And so I think the suspicion right now is that one of those was blown over, who knows what happened. It was, and basically lit that fire in the grass. And I think the company has come forward and said that, yes, we believe that was the start, at least of the Smokehouse Creek fire. I don't know about the other two. And so, when you're in this kind of conditions, when you're dry, when you've got that wind, it doesn't take much, So this time it was a power line. It could have been, some piece of equipment somewhere or an individual at a campsite. So, unfortunately, the conditions were just right when that hit, and it went real fast. So
is there a common start to wildfires? Is there one thing that, like, 7 out of 10 times it's because of this, or is it much more random than that?
I would say, from what I see, it's a good mix of just about everything. It could be a chain dragging down the highway. It could be a tire blowing out and those pieces of hot rubber flying off into the ditch. For the power lines, the wind's blowing and actually making those power lines touch can create an arc. Then that can also blow a transformer. And we've all seen those go and just sparks go everywhere. So it's a pretty wide array of causes that we see that lead to these large scale wildfires. But like John said, it's not anything that we're a stranger to. We've had the big ones that he mentioned in 2017, we also had a 662 acre fire. 2018, we had a 286 acre fire. So these are not something we're unfamiliar with, but they're definitely something we want to work to mitigate the losses from.
Yeah, right on. It is, as I dug into this preparing, it was, you know, our team would relate back to certain years. It sounds like 2017. Like, there are certain situations, and Tel, you were mentioning this to me before we hit record, El Nino years.
Absolutely.
Sort of set up the situation, right? Which is anybody, like from the Canadian border to the Texas border, it's been a pretty mild winter, and it was an El Nino year, which created the situation here, right?
For sure. And one of the things to keep in mind with El Nino and La Nina, those are the two kind of sides of that coin. With El Nino, different parts of the country experience different things with it. So El Nino in the Northeast can be drought conditions. But here in the Central Plains, especially Southern Plains, that typically leads to a more mild winter and more precipitation. So when we have more rain falling, we're going to end up with more grass, more forbs, more fuel, essentially. And so if we look at those years where we've started to transition out of El Nino into La Nina, we start to see a little bit drier conditions, a little bit more favorable for those mega fires. And in 2017, we had just come out of a major El, make sure I've got my Nino shift right. we had just come out of an El Nino that was a pretty big one and had led to a big boom in quail populations across the Southern Plains. With that, we had a ton of fuel resources. Right now, we're still in an El Nino, but we're starting to transition back into a La Nina as we speak. So these definitely kind of line up with the weather patterns. And, you know, that's one piece of the puzzle that we can use to help communicate some of these issues to land managers and folks all across the country.
Yeah. All right. So on this podcast, Thomas, I'm going to direct this to you. On this podcast over the years, we've dedicated a lot of episodes to prescribed fire. It's one of the major tools that habitat land managers have in the toolbox. You know, whether it's grazing or seeding, you know, prescribed fire is one of those major top four tools. For folks that haven't listened to one of those podcasts dedicated exclusively to prescribed fire, let's kind of get them up to speed for this particular episode just on what prescribed fire does, what fire does for a grassland ecosystem, and then what a general response is for the birds that we love the most.
Yeah, great point, Bob. And I think for those who may not be aware, you know, there's two general type of fires. We've been talking about wildfires and prescribed fires. And as mentioned, wildfires, think about it, it's going to be burning on Mother Nature's conditions. Typically, it's hotter, it's drier, it's windier. Not always the case, but that's when a lot of them get really out of hand and you get these catastrophic or mega fires or the fires that really hit the news. And so they just get more publicity. Prescribed fires, on the other hand, kind of like you go into a doctor and you have an ailment of some sort. Well, our land, it has an ailment or it needs some sort of improvement, and here's a recommendation or here's a prescription on how we can improve it. And that prescription usually entails multiple factors saying, hey, if you want to do X, Y, and Z, let's have these certain weather conditions. So we're really looking at, because it's not only flame management and fire intensity, but also smoke management. And so we're going to be looking at what are those climatic conditions and moisture level conditions to best treat that resource concern. Sometimes that prescription might be when everything's dry. Other times it might be when that dormant season or winter season. Other times it might be when it's the growing season and there's a lot of green out, again, depending on those management goals. But that's a lot of times when coming into a prescription or a prescribed fire. And depending on the state you're in, there's different legalities that have to be followed and minimum criteria that have to be met. But ultimately, it all needs to go into a plan. And that plan, you know, needs to be available and say, yep, I'm following this plan. It is prescribed. It's meeting these objectives. And then you're technically conducting a prescribed burn if and when you've met all that. Additionally, to go back to your question, Bob, on, okay, we got wildfire, we got prescribed fire. What does that mean for our land?
Yep.
And nearly 100 years ago, Aldo Leopold talked about tools of habitat management. The same tools that can destroy are also the same tools that can improve or enhance. Well, we got a great scenario of that right now. We got wildfire, who, for the time being, it looks very bleak, dismal, catastrophic, moonscape in some, you know, in some verbiage. That can look very destructive. Depending on that system, and especially depending on Mother Nature and when we're getting rainfall, soil moisture, all that, is really going to dictate that response time. How quick are those plants going to come back? Your forbs or your flowering plants and your grasses are going to be the first to respond. Luckily, that's exactly what a lot of our wildlife need. That's the most palatable. That's the most nutritious. That's where we get our highest level of insects. And depending on the time of year, that's exactly what our beloved species such as quail or other upland birds are looking for. The trick is finding, how can we have the best of all worlds? We want to have quality food, but we still want them to have structure to nest in, to hide from predators, etc. So finding that balance is really the art and at times the science of wildlife management. How do we use tools such as fire along with other things so we can create these quality habitat conditions for them?
Yeah, so I boiled this down, I think about, like, you know, quail chicks, the size of my thumb, and I'm holding up my thumb for listeners that, but everybody can look at their thumb, and quail chick is really that small. And, you know, if a grassland habitat, and we've all hunted this habitat that hasn't been managed in, you know, if you're a pheasant hunter in probably like 10, 15 years, and it gets clumpy or, you know, or just matted down, it happens much quicker in the southern United States. It grows much more, much more aggressively. And you think about that quail, the size of your thumb, trying to move through, and they can't do it. And that's where prescribed fire, it's so critically important for quail. And correct me if I'm wrong here, guys, but it's for them to have bare ground, particularly as chicks, to move around from patch of grass to patch of shrub, to, and then to be able to find food and escape. And fire does, and in the right amount, prescription, it lessens that grassland to create some bare ground, to reinvigorate growth of the forbs, and to prevent it from getting so jungle-like where nothing can move through it. Is that an accurate description, Thomas?
I'd say so. You know, I've heard some people say thumb, or even some people will compare them to the size of a golf ball. And you start
with legs is what I always throw out.
Yeah, or little bumblebee, a lot of names. But think of something about an inch or so in size. And, you know, I like using that golf ball or cotton ball. Can you easily roll it, or can it maneuver or navigate through something? And even whether it's native grass, introduced grass, et cetera, you know, if it's too thick, it's difficult for them to successfully move through there, to forage on the ground, et cetera. And then think of an adult. An adult might be about 6 inches tall, so maybe a softball or a little bit bigger. You know, same thing. Do they have maneuverability, places to eat, places to hide? And so finding that balance, and fire does absolutely what you described, Bob. It can basically put that ecological reset button, and depending on what it does, it will burn through an area, sometimes completely, sometimes patchy. And a lot of times patchy, you know, we as humans like to, when we're drawing a picture, we like to fill in all the lines completely. Well, that's not how Mother Nature tends to work.
Mowing the lawn, right?
Yeah, like, mowing the lawn. We want to be edge to edge, beautiful monoculture. Mother Nature's not like that. She likes it a little sloppy. She likes it, you know, a mosaic. And so having some stuff that gets grazed or doesn't get grazed, gets burned, doesn't get burned, and just that diversity of plants, diversity of habitat types, diversity of resources is what's best for all of our wildlife. Because it I like to tell folks, Bob, I don't know about the town you live in, but or area you live, but if you had one restaurant, you're going to have, you know, you might have folks willing to go there each and every day. Yeah. But if you had the, you know, the buffet of all buffets that you might see at Vegas or elsewhere, you're going to have a whole lot more diversity of folks and cultures coming to that. And same thing for wildlife. The more diversity of plants and habitat types and structures you can make, the more diverse animals you'll have and the longer you can keep them there throughout the year and satisfy their needs.
Graham, John, you wanted to add to this conversation.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, those are that's exactly right. Thomas is hitting the nail on the head there. And I always think about, you know, sort of, yeah, these chicks moving, navigating the landscape is it's, you know, beyond just a physical barrier, you know, you just, I always think about it from an energy perspective. And, you know, we kind of always talk about this, you know, hunting out west, you're like, you know, wildlife in a lot of scenarios that we quote unquote say they're lazy, but they're really just looking for the path of least resistance, right? So, you know, when you're out there hunting, you know, you might follow an elk trail, you might follow a mule deer trail because, you know, they're finding their way up that mountain with the least amount of energy expenditure possible. And so, you know, we think about those little chicks and you think about them going up and down and up and down and up and down. And, you know, energy is such is so critical to be maintaining, you know, to be growing quickly. You know, the faster you can grow, the faster you can fly, the faster, you know, you're able to forage at, a variety of foods out there, whether it be insects, grass, or whatever it may be. And so, yeah, just the energy expenditure to move around those thick landscapes is one of the big inhibitors, you know, beyond just the physical barrier. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, the easier we can make it for them to get around, to find that forage on the ground, to find those insects, or just to simply, you know, escape whatever may be behind them or move with mom, you know, those are just, it's so critical to have that bare ground available for them. So,
you know, and Thomas brought this element up, and I want to circle back, just put it in kind of general public terms too, just the way I was thinking about it. So one element is, you know, cleaning up the detritus, the matted grass at the base layer. The other element that Thomas brought up is the shrub cover, the bushes. And I think back to a podcast I did with Dwayne Elmore, who worked for Oklahoma State at the time, works for Tall Timbers now. And he really struck a chord with me, you know, a shrub cover in the north for pheasants or rough grouse. It's, we think of it as winter cover, it's shelter. In the quail range, that's a way for birds to find shade. And it is also escape cover. And that's one of the big problems with wildfires is the intensity and the heat in the elimination of the shrubs, the bushes, and more so than, like, Thomas, you made the point that the grass and the forbs are going to bounce back pretty quickly, especially with some moisture, but it's the shrubs, the escape, the shade that is going to be much more, create much more vulnerabilities for the birds that make it through. And Tell, you're waving me down. You have a comment to add.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I often encounter when I'm talking with folks about this very topic is we think of quail as a grassland species, whether that's scaled quail or whether that's bobwhite. When you think I go to the grassland, that's where I find them. But really, if we really dig down, quail are a shrub obligate. So the shrub is the most important thing for them. And when we have a fire like the Smokehouse Creek fire, I mean, that's a million acres plus of continuous burn. When we have a prescribed fire, that may be 100 acres, that may be 1,000 acres, depending on the overall size of the property and the goals. But if we've burnt 100 acres, there's a neighboring 100 acres that still has those shrub components that are available. So we can really start to provide all of the different levels of succession. That's the fancy scholastic term for it. But all of those levels of succession give us all of the habitat components that quail are going to need to survive throughout a year.
Really well said. Go ahead.
I was also going to throw out that, you know, prescribed fire, there's been a whole lot of talk about it in the last 15 years, but prescribed fire is not a new fad to anywhere, really, especially the Great Plains. In fact, the Plains tribes that called the Great Plains home for thousands of years prior to European settlement understood the importance of fire, and they would use it to their advantage, not only in managing the forbs and grasses, but also to help actually draw in wildlife like bison that they relied on so heavily. And so when we mention a species being the fire bird, that's not with, you know, it's not tongue in cheek. That's actually based in the way that quail would go about it. Turkey as well. They're one of the first to really flock into those burned areas because they know that seeds are going to be readily available. They're going to be right on the ground. They're just not going to have to pick through anything to get them. Bugs have also been cooked up. That's one of the reasons we cook our food. It makes it easier to digest. So like everything really kind of piles on with fire when it's done correctly. That enhances everything for wildlife.
Go ahead, Thomas. You're flagging me down.
Yeah, I was just, you know, for me, it's, I can conceptualize 50 acres. I can conceptualize 100. I can even at times on a high point conceptualize a couple thousand. I'm still trying to wrap my head around what does a million acres look like?
Rhode Island.
So and that's what I was about to say, Tell, is, so I was looking up just some general perspective. So remember, this is one, the fires that started a little over 2 weeks ago, they're in the Texas Panhandle and went into Oklahoma. There was one in particular that made the headlines. That was that Smokehouse Creek fire. It is now over 1 million acres. I think they have it currently at 1,058,000. But regardless, over 1 million acres. That was one of the fires. And then the others combined added up another 100 plus thousand acres, or close to 200,000. But that one fire, the Smokehouse Creek, that is about 1.5 sizes, or 1.5 times the size of Rhode Island. Just itself. And that's contiguous. Collectively, now granted, luckily all those fires aren't touching, but the fires that we've had in the last 2 weeks are now collectively about 1.25 million acres, which is about the size of Delaware. And so you start thinking about that, you know, start conceptualizing, okay, we burn the size of Rhode Island, and we're talking about the need to be having these resources, be it shrubs, be it food, be it spacing. You know, it makes sense for things that are close to that edge, but when you're kind of, you know, a mile in plus or in the middle of that, that's a different story.
Well, and so you mentioned that. One of the ways that I look at the effects of these large-scale fires is I think of it like an archery target. So if you were to look at these large-scale fires, one, whenever the cold front actually hit that Smokehouse Creek fire, it was a 90-mile wide head fire, briefly, but still, that's 90 miles wide of continuous fire. That's terrifying. But when we look at the effects to the wildlife, the plants, the animals, and the communities there, we really get kind of that bullseye effect. So in the bullseye, in the most heavily burned or most heavily impacted areas, that's going to take the longest amount of time for that wildlife to really get back in there and reestablish fully. But along the perimeters of that, the edge, if you've heard a champion of this podcast, you can probably count the times you've heard edge talked about. But those one and two rings, the outer edge of that archery target, are going to be the least impacted. So the wildlife are going to quickly start moving back into those areas. And then they'll reestablish in the twos and the threes and the fours. And before long, the entire target, the entire burned area has been reestablished with that wildlife.
Yeah, that's really helpful to explain it that way, because the just human nature is, you know, you hear 1.1 million acres and you're like, there's nothing left. It's all gone. So that's where I want to take us next, is sort of what is the current situation? What's the wildlife response? You know, and I know there's been some moisture, which I got to believe is like a Christmas gift at this point. Let's start with Oklahoma. What's the current situation after the 150,000 acres, and anecdotal, you know, what are you hearing wildlife response?
So in the areas that were burned, you start to see not only the plants and animals, but the people kind of go into survival mode. So they're trying to scrounge for those resources that they need to be able to just continue daily life. And that's what we see in these burned areas over and over again. So the short-term impacts right now, we're just hitting our big green up for the year. So plants are really just starting to come out anyways. And and the stuff that burned as far as grasses and its desirability was pretty low in protein. So most of the wildlife wasn't really utilizing it much. What we do see is whenever we get that little bit of rain, that little bit of moisture, and the plants start to come up, the tender shoots are loaded with higher protein, vitamins and minerals, and really just better nutritional composition than the stuff that was there before. Now, that's not only going to help the wildlife, that's going to help livestock as well, and help those farmers and ranchers be able to rebound from their losses as far as the livestock side goes. And, you know, like we said earlier, getting rid of all that thatch is going to help ground nesters. That's going to help with a little bit of that that rebound as far as the bird numbers go. But yeah, that's generally what the short-term impacts look like in Oklahoma. We're definitely keeping an eye on things. We'll be doing roadside surveys and that type of work that we normally do to try and get a handle on what the numbers look like for those specific routes and specific areas that were impacted.
All right, so then we go to Texas, which is on a scale of 12 times the magnitude of impact here. John, what's the situation for wildlife today in Texas?
Yeah, Bob. Well, at this point, it's tough to, the scale is so unprecedented. You know, we do have some, as we were talking about before in 06, we have some kind of reference for this and what would happen. But, we know at least in this fire, we saw, obviously, like any animal experiences any fire, they're going to start and move out of that area. You know, we unfortunately did see some direct impacts on the fire, which is to say we do have images coming out of cubbies that were not able to escape the fire. And, it sort of makes sense. At a smaller scale, a cubby can move. But, for any of us that have hunted before, you bump up a bird more than two, maybe even three times. I mean, they basically can't even fly anymore. And so, even the best bobwhite on the best day, making its best flush flight is probably only a couple hundred yards, a couple hundred meters, whatever it may be. And so, you can imagine with how fast that fire was burning, even if you get up and move twice, and unless they've got the smarts to get up and go over, 30-foot flame lengths, they're moving away from the fire. And so we did see some of that direct impact. That area is also one of our biggest prairie chicken areas in the state. It's probably our biggest stronghold in the state. It's our connectivity into Oklahoma, up into Kansas. And so, to be determined. I mean, those birds obviously can get up and fly farther away. And I think the one kind of touch point we have on that is the 17 fire. And so we have it in Texas. We have two big study sites. One's called the Hemp Hill Study Site, and then we have another one that's southwest of Lubbock, where I'm stationed. And that area is about 70,000 acres, and we have a pretty good monitoring data set back into the 50s, really kind of, the numbers are really confident since the late 1990s. But after that 17 fire, when that entire study area burned, we did see birds back in that area within a few weeks, just sort of making exploratory flights, looking around. But, I think the general consensus is they were not going to stay there. It burned about the same time of year. And when we think about a fire at that scale, you're just all that nesting cover, all that protective cover, as we've been talking about, is gone. And so some chickens remained in that area, but a lot of them went to the other regions around, So in this case, I think in this fire, we're probably going to see a lot of our chickens moving out to the north, moving to other areas of good grass cover, at least temporarily. Go ahead.
Just for clarity, we're talking lesser prairie chickens, which are in an extremely vulnerable state as it is.
Yeah. They're recently listed under the Endangered Species Act. And so there's concern there, whether that sticks or not is up for debate. But, the population, regardless of any listing, is in need of assistance. So, yeah, losing that, it was really tough. And I actually spent, we were actually up there this winter. And I mean, it's just a shame for that region too, because we have been struggling with drought for quite a few years. But that panhandle region down into what we might refer to as the South Plains, so the area south of Amarillo, they had really been making up some ground in the last 18 months or so, getting some good rainfall. And to your point about the wildfires before, the one thing that, we're all kind of, happy about is that area did get some moisture. They got some snowfall, about a month ago. So there was some of that residual moisture really kick off what Tell was talking about, getting some of that regrowth in there. So, certainly direct impacts of the fire. We did see some mortalities, but I think more than anything, we saw birds moving out of the area. So, we do have our LEC surveys coming up. We'll be able to assess, how early they're coming back. And I guess for the listeners too, it's, it wasn't a homogenous just burn, you know. I mean, if you get to the western side, there's actually some patchy areas where, you know, we've had some folks saying, hey, that looks pretty good in a patchy landscape. And, you know, really what this burned was what we call our Canadian River watershed region. So that the Canadian River basically east to west cuts across that Pan Am region, and it's big grassland, big breaky country. And so, you know, we know that fire didn't have the opportunity to drop into every break or burn every acre in there. So, you know, there's going to be fingers in there that are going to retain wildlife, hold on to wildlife. And we heard that same thing about 3 years ago. Kansas burned pretty strong up there. And their upland biologist said the same thing, that birds, you know, they were using basically anything they could find in those patchy areas. So I think it's going to sort of be a gradient of how much those areas are usable, you know, as we move into the future. But certainly I think managing expectation in the short term is really important for folks to understand. We're going to have some birds in the area, but a lot of that is going to be, I don't want to say unusable, but just not occupied. There aren't going to be birds there for some time. So
One thing to throw in there just real quick is that it's not just the quail and prairie chickens that were impacted. So the, all of the wildlife were impacted. So some of those nest predators were also impacted. So the survivors, if you will, as far as the upland birds go, might have a little bit easier of a time transitioning because of this fire, because not, it wasn't just them impacted. So the neighbors were too. So everybody will be working to rebound, if you will.
So the rebound, how long before this becomes really high quality habitat in birds? You know, the expectation, if the weather's right, the habitat's going to be there, and potentially there's a hockey stick effect of quail populations and, you know, hopefully lesser prairie chickens, maybe even some roosters. How quickly does that happen, Tel?
So it depends. That's the qualified answer there. If it depends. But most of the Great Plains historically saw some type of fire every 3 to 8 years, kind of depending on where you're at in the plains. So for it to be 100% perfect back to just primo habitat, it might take portions of that 3 years. It might be a year down the road. It might be 6 months down the road. Ultimately, it comes down to that weather variable, and that's the one big kicker on quail habitat that we can't control. So if we do continue to get some spring rains, it should be able to rebound pretty quickly, especially those grasses and forbs and the shrubs that we talked about earlier. Again, they've evolved with fire. So it didn't kill them, but it did set them back a little bit. So it may be 3 years before they really put out fruit. So our sand plum jelly might be a little bit delayed for the next couple of years. But nature will find the way. I think that's the Jurassic Park quote, right? So it depends on a lot of factors and a lot of variables, but I would expect that within a matter of a couple of years, you really won't be able to see those scars on the landscape.
Let's transition to the third element I wanted to talk about in regards to this podcast, and that's the role prescribed fire can play in mitigating wildfires. So I mentioned this in the introduction, fighting fire with fire. So again, as I prepped for this and as I talked to Thomas and our team, two recurring themes emerged for the benefits of, you know, prescribed fire as it relates to preventing wildfires. And I want you to tackle one and John the second. So we've touched on this a bit, but decreasing the fuel load. I think I've mentioned the word detritus. You dropped another term that I'm blanking on now a moment ago.
Thatch. There's all sorts of stuff.
That was the one. Thatch is what I was thinking of. So talk about how prescribed fire used correctly can lessen the fuel load. What's that mean?
So first, what's a fuel load? So there's fine fuels, there's heavy fuels. That's basically the dead stuff, the combustible materials that are out there on the landscape. So when we're looking at the intensities of a fire, if you had a landscape that was dominated by mesquite or eastern red cedar or those bushy woody plants like that, those are going to be hotter fires just because the fuel load is higher. They're more volatile. They're more combustible. when we have grasses, those are considered fine fuels. So they're fairly fast burning, but they're not going to get super hot. And that's how the plains evolved. You know, I mentioned a little bit ago that most of the plains saw fire every 3 to 8 years. So if you had in your imagination this kind of patchwork quilt, if you will, of parts of it got burned this year, parts got burned 2 years ago, parts got burned 3 years ago, there's really not the fuel load on the landscape to be able to carry that fire. This year, especially, we have that heavy fuel load, much like we did in 2017 that we talked about earlier. But once we have that fire, from a quail's perspective, or without the fire, those increases in forbs and grasses from a quail's perspective are great. There's more cover, there's more food. But as a land manager, we need to look at it as a little bit of a balance, because the unmanaged areas or the more difficult to manipulate areas, like those river bottoms and draws, those increased fuel loads can create a really bad mix or a large scale problem on the drier and windier days, just like we saw in the last month. But using prescribed fire, or as you said, fighting with fire, helps to keep those fuel loads in check. And it really wasn't until the late 1800s or early 1900s that fire became such a taboo, when settlers focused on stopping any fires that appeared and allowing those intolerant species to fire, like eastern red cedar, honey mesquite, to flourish. But if we manage that fuel load on our terms, it'll always be safer than a wildfire. Safer for us, safer for our livelihoods, and safer for the wildlife as well.
You know, one thing that I want to circle back and clarify as you talk about, you know, eastern red cedars and mesquite, and, you know, earlier we talked about the importance of brush and shrubs, and it's really critical that, you know, folks that are managing land for habitat understand good shrubs, bad shrubs. And, you know, eastern red cedars, we've talked again a number of times on this podcast, terrible for water, sucking water out of aquifers, can create a biological desert because they just choke out everything. Eastern red cedars are the scourge of upland birds.
1,000%, yes. And one of the big things is, throughout the last, I'll pick on the last 50 years of land management history, we've tried to take something that was already pretty great as far as the Great Plains ecosystem and try to figure out how to make it better. I've actually got a brochure from the 1950s that talks about you should plant eastern red cedars for quail. Obviously, that kind of shot ourselves in the foot. Like a lot of the management plans and recommendations from the last, you know, 50, 60 years. But historically, these plants weren't evolved with fire. They were not tolerant to fire. So when we're talking about a shrub, a quail might utilize it if there's nothing else on the landscape. But what is the actual thing that a quail wants to be able to use? And that's species like sand plum, like sumac, like, I mean, there's the sky's the limit as far as the list of actual native shrub species. But when we start to get to those woodier plants, those more tree-like species like mesquite, like cedars, like salt cedars, and that list can also go on and on. Those plants weren't what the birds really responded to. Those weren't what they evolved to live amongst. We still see situations where they will go to them and utilize them when they're experiencing habitat stress or some type of lacking thing on the landscape. But for the most part, those aren't what a quail wants. It's kind of like if we wanted to get a motorcycle and we came home with a moped. We're making do. We've got something that's, you know, checking that box. But really, we wanted that nice, big, beefy motorcycle that we could go cross country on. But we're just going to have to make do. So instead of putting a Band-Aid on it and going with the moped, work on improving things and actually make it your motorcycle. Yeah. Holding off until you've actually got the habitat work done. And ultimately, the birds will flourish because the right things are there. Thomas mentioned earlier, like the buffet, you know, if we ate nothing but cheeseburgers and fries every day, we're not going to be that healthy of a population. But if we have that, all of the things we're supposed to have, all the things the doctor says we're supposed to eat and be healthy, we're healthier for it.
Okay, and the second element of prescribed fire in mitigating wildfires that I want to go to relates to the town of Borger, Texas, and how the town of Borger used prescribed fire, which ultimately helped save the city. John, can you tell us that story?
In terms of Borger, Texas, you know, it's a real interesting scenario. I think there's been some social media, some TV reports about, you know, how this community basically took, you know, their fire protection plan into their own hands. And so, you know, oftentimes we think about, you know, this wildland urban interface, you know, and we hear about that most in like an area like a California where we have big, you know, fires, where we have communities up into these mountains, up into these forest zones. And so, you know, I think wildland urban interface, which is a term we use for, you know, where these wildlands meet up with urban communities and, you know, where there is risk to those communities, you sort of like generally think of that in a forested environment. But we have the same thing here in a lot of these small town communities. I mean, these rangelands, These are bumping right up onto the edge of those communities. And so, you know, Borger was really an example of sort of learning from the past. And they have stated this, their city managers have talked about this, you know, after the 06 fires, you know, which again, 900,000 acre fire up in that same country came very close to their community. You know, they decided to take their fire protection plan in their own hand. And so, fortunately, you know, there are resources, not just here in Texas, but for people across the country to basically take a look at, you know, what kind of protection they have. And the Texas A&M Forest Service actually offers a community wildfire protection plan for folks. And so, you know, the city was able to work with, you know, not just the local community, but state, federal partners, and then the Forest Service to say, hey, what do we need to do to protect ourselves? And so, in this scenario, you know, back in November of 23, so just a few months ago, you know, they did a prescribed burn, a 7-mile burn along the edge of their city. And the pictures are clear. You know, that wildfire came right up to where they had done that burn. And basically, we talked about it too, those fuel loads before. So basically, they had reduced the fuel load, created a physical barrier between the town and some rangeland. And that 7-mile burn, protected the entire community. You could see the black right up to that 7-mile line. Dead stop right there. And so, you know, you might say to yourself, well, hey, maybe that if that fire even burns right up to the community, maybe, you know, those buildings aren't going to catch on fire. But we saw just miles down the road in some of the other towns that we did see loss of life. We did see loss of infrastructure out there when fires did get right up to the border, which is not to suggest that those communities did anything wrong. It just suggests that, you know, it's not hyperbole to say that this did save buildings. This potentially saved lives. So, you know, this is a really active approach to fire protection. And again, you don't think about that as much in these kind of areas. You think about those big forested environments, but it's just as important here. And so, you know, Borger is an example. And I think that, you know, I think other communities are going to pick up that torch moving forward. And hopefully that's something that, that they're able to access down the road.
Yeah. Kudos to the foresight, for the folks in Borger that, it obviously saved the town. Because it encouraged folks to look on Google, just Google Borger, B-O-R-G-E-R, Texas. And the news stories and the photography tells the story. It tells the story. It's there in one snapshot that prescribed fire saved that community. As we round third and head towards home and close out this conversation, we'll start with Tal. I first of all want to thank all three of you. Super short notice, I asked you to join and share the stories of what's going on in Oklahoma and in Texas. And I couldn't be happier with how this conversation's gone. I really appreciate all three of you sharing the insight. I'm sure it's super busy right now for your departments and what you're doing to respond and you know, take care of the wildlife in the states and spring habitat planning season and everything else you must be dealing with. So I sincerely appreciate it on behalf of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Let's start with you, Tal. Anything that you want to leave as a closing thought or emphasize as we round out this podcast?
Again, I first want to say thanks for having us on. This is definitely a topic that needs to be talked about. If I was to give a couple of things to listeners as far as, you know, mission statements or bullet points to go take on, one is continue to care. We're having this conversation because the membership and leadership of Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever cared and wanted to talk about the impacts that are going on here in the Southern Plains. And continue to care from the chapter level all the way to the national level. I would also point out that we're very fortunate here in the Southern Plains with both Oklahoma and Texas that there are folks that will assist with prescribed fire, whether that is boots on the ground with Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever through area biologists, whether that is state level biologists like myself and John, whether that is an NGO or other joint venture or something like that, there are folks that are willing to help carry the torch, literally. One of those here in Oklahoma is the Oklahoma Prescribed Burn Association. I know there's examples of prescribed burn associations in Texas. There's also a lot of good educational materials that are made available through extension offices and land-grant universities all across the United States. So reach out to your local folks. If you can't find that information, I'm happy to help get that information into your hands. I'm pretty easy to Google and find. I mean, Bob found me, right? So feel free to reach out to the experts that are out there to talk about fire. Obviously, all of us, that's a topic that we've got to kind of constrain ourselves on, or we're going to go on for about 4 hours. But again, I will leave it with those simple bullets. And again, thank you for having us on.
Right on. If you Google Tell Oklahoma yeah. Quail, you'll get yeah. the right guy.
Yep, that's for sure.
Closing thoughts, John.
No, again, Bob, great to be here. And again, just our extend our thoughts to all those folks. You know, we're just it's a tight community out here in West Texas. You know, we care for each other. So great to see. I guess, you know, only one real final thought, which is, we talk about managing expectations with populations generally from year to year. You know, that is the emphasis we provide in every forecast that we do. That's that's what every farmer and rancher is doing as they head into the growing season, or when they're in that planting season. It's manage expectations. You never know what's going to happen. So I think, you know, for everyone, this is going to be a multi-year recovery. I think we have to accept that up front and say this is going to take a few years, whether that's, you know, whether you're a cattle producer or whether you're someone looking at it from a wild versus hipster, or whether you're someone that is focusing on both. It's going to take some time. So I think manage your expectations. And, you know, really, in these tragedies, we do have the opportunity to use these as a learning experience. And so I think we've learned from the previous fires that we've had, and this is another opportunity for us to learn. Maybe it's an opportunity for folks to reset their management. It's another opportunity for folks to emphasize the good things that they've already been doing. And so I think as we move forward, just supporting those communities. And as Tel said, I think there's a lot of folks out there you can reach out to, whether that's an NGO, whether that's a state, whether that's another local partner that can help provide guidance or can give you that detailed information that you might want. So manage expectations. You know, it is not a short game, wildlife conservation, rangeland management. We're talking long-term, you know, sustained gains over time. And I think this is just the beginning of what will be gains in the near future. So.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's particularly important to emphasize that when we're talking about prescribed fire as it relates to preventing wildfires, it's a cultural shift. And that isn't going to, it's a long game. You know, it took a long time for us to get here, and it's going to take a long time to reverse that perspective of fear all fire rather than putting good fire to work to prevent bad fire. Really, really good closing thought, John. All right, Thomas, mic drop time. Final words, and they're all yours.
Mic drop, man. I really appreciate what Tel and John said, managing expectations and just being, just caring. There was, you know, a lot of things can fall into those bullets. I was definitely taking some notes throughout this and trying to figure out what might be good to close on. And and I think it's just, y'all have already hit upon it, but I want to add to it just, you know, hearts and condolences and prayers are going out to all those impacted, not only those with lives and livelihoods lost, but there's been so many folks, not only in the panhandle, but elsewhere in Texas and the United States that have been rallying together, you know, donating their time, their talents, their resources, and that is so appreciated. You know, it's a shame that it takes a natural disaster of this magnitude for us to come together, but man, what an opportunity it is to really build around why America's so great. And so just greatly appreciate that. As far as the fire world goes, You know, yeah, this is a it's a wake-up call. That's exactly what it is. We're going to recover. The landscape has evolved to recover, especially here in the Great Plains, but it's not a reason for us to be pumping the brakes. Controversially, we need to be, you know, putting more fuel to it, even if it's on the planning side, the discussing side. Need to be getting proactive, such as the city of Borger, as we described. Heck, even 2 weeks ago or a couple weeks ago, John and I were at a meeting in Houston, and that very same time, the Houston Arboretum was conducting their fourth annual prescribed burn. If you can burn in downtown Houston, Texas, one of the biggest cities in America, there shouldn't be any reason we couldn't successfully burn elsewhere in the country. And so, yes, sometimes it takes more planning and effort, but it can be done. And as Tell so well said, there's a lot of resources available to folks, be it state agencies, NGOs, our team, and just I've been really blessed and pleased to be getting the phone calls we've been getting. Even as these fires are actively going, we've been getting phone calls from landowners, from chapter members and others saying, hey, how can we do more to enhance our habitat, to prepare for future fires? And we're doing exactly that. For multiple months now, we've been working outside the city of Spearman, not necessarily on like what Borger did, but on a property near Spearman. And their goal starting last fall was wildfire prevention. And I am very excited to say that even after among all this, all the hype, all the news, that leadership of that property is still wanting to move forward, saying, yep, this isn't a time to slow down. We're just now at the beginning of this year's wildfire season. It's going to get hotter. It's going to get drier. It's going to get windier. How can we best prepare for that? How can we best manage that? And how can we best enhance our bird habitat along the way? And so a lot of good things falling into place. I appreciate Quail Forever's leadership and chapters, as Tell said, caring and looking forward to what all comes from this.
Yeah. Yeah. And that chapter in Spearman, Texas, you were talking about, the Paulo Duro Pheasants Forever chapter, is helping be part of that prescribed burn effort there. So shout out to the Paulo Duro chapter. And folks, final thought, no matter where you are in the country, Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, the Dakotas, you name it, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, prescribed fire is a critically important tool for our favorite ecosystems, our favorite birds. It's secret that many upland birds are named the firebird. You know, sharp-tailed grouse is the firebird. Bobwhite quail are the firebird. You know, prescribed fire is critically important to habitat management. And you can go to the pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org websites. Go to Find a Biologist tab and get connected with one of our biologists. They can talk to you about prescribed fire. You might be able to qualify for some federal or state programs to help you. Might qualify for EQIP or who knows, CRP, a state-specific program. Lots of different tools to put prescribed fire to work for you, for habitat management and to prevent wildfires. Fellas, thank you very much for sharing your expertise, your time. Sincerely appreciated. All the best to the folks in Oklahoma and Texas. Know that this is the start of wildfire season. Hopefully it's the end of the wildfires for this particular year, and we just have prescribed burns happening here forth. I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.